We have been considering, that's chapters 13 through 23. You could call this section by the one word that occurs repeatedly in these chapters, the word burden. And these are heavy messages detailing the Lord's coming judgment upon the Gentile nations that were Israel's neighbors and were Israel's threat. So in chapter 13, verse 1, you have the burden against Babylon. And then the final one in chapter 23, verse 1, you have the burden against Tyre. But today in chapter 15, you will see that this is the burden of Moab. These chapters were written about their neighbors. And yet, those who would benefit from these chapters were not the Gentile nations. Those who would benefit from reading these chapters were the people of Israel. Israel was small, while their neighbors were mighty. Israel's geography put them right in the middle of the war zone. It seems that they are always in the war zone. So these 11 chapters are Isaiah's prophecy of what the Lord is not to just one nation, but what the Lord is to all nations. He is the Lord of all. He is in control of all that comes on all the nations. He guides and judges their fate. Israel's tendency was to trust their own solutions and their own way, and Isaiah's message is that they would trust in the Lord alone, the one who not only was in charge of their fate, but also who guides and judges the fate of all nations. And we need that kind of encouragement just as Israel did. We are prone to trust our own way and our own solutions, and we need this encouragement to trust in the Lord alone. We trust in Him for salvation by grace plus nothing. It's not Jesus plus what we can do. It is Jesus plus nothing. Jesus alone. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 22, the prophet encourages the nation of Israel to cease from man whose breath is in his nostrils. And we tend to fear man. And we are encouraged by the Lord Jesus that we should not fear them that destroy the body, but rather fear Him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. We should trust in the Lord alone. We're prone to trust our own way, the idols of my own. And instead, these chapters of Isaiah are encouraging us to submit the life that I have to the glory of God. So Israel should trust in Him alone. And again, that is the purpose of these chapters that we're going to look at this afternoon. That Israel should trust in the Lord alone. That's the purpose behind this burden that is coming upon Moab. So let me begin by asking us the question, who is Moab? The nation of Moab arose from Lot's sinful relationship with his oldest daughter. In Genesis chapter 19, verse 37, you see that the son who was born from that relationship was called Moab. And the descendants of Moab occupied the plains to the southeast of the Dead Sea. So if you want to take a moment to find a map in your Bible that would show you the Middle East, you'd find the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, and then south of that, the Dead Sea. And if you look to the southeast of that, you would find two territories, the territory of Moab and the territory of Edom. So just in case those Those things don't mean very much. In Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 5, when the nation of Israel had wandered through the wilderness for 40 years and they were on the verge of crossing the Jordan back into claim the promised land, Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 5, they were in the plains of Moab. So it's through this region that Israel came to enter the land of Canaan, through Moab. And just out of interest, in connection with that, you remember what happened to Moses. Because Moses struck the rock the second time, rather than speaking to it, he was not allowed to go into the land. He did not sanctify the Lord before the people of Israel. And the Lord allowed him not to go into the land, but allowed him to climb up into a mountain. And from that mountain, he was able to view the land. Deuteronomy chapter 34, verse 1 describes that as the Mount Pisgah. And just a cross-reference to that, Numbers 21, verse 20, Mount Pisgah is in the land of, you guessed it, in the land of Moab. In the land of Moab. So if you were to scan down through chapter 15, you would find that this chapter is full of place names. In verse 1, for example, there's Ar of Moab, Ker of Moab. Verse 2, Bajith and Dibon, and so on. I'm not going to go through all the names. I counted 27 of them. And I think that these are named because this land was given to Moab by the Lord. When Israel came to the land, they were not to war with Moab. That land was given to them by the Lord. But it became a land that was constantly under different occupation and different rulers. So that brings me then to the second question. I should have pointed out that because of this being descendants of Lot, that made them relatives of Abraham's descendants. That's going to be important in one of the details that we'll see later. My second question then is, why was Moab a problem? In comparison with the other military forces, the force of Babylon, the force of Assyria, Moab was a small nation. But throughout history, throughout the centuries, there were three continuing problems that Moab caused Israel. Number one, there was persistent hostility between Moab and Israel. So you weren't expecting a multiple choice quiz, but you've got it anyway. Do you remember who hired Balaam to curse Israel? That's very close. Balak. Do you know who he was king of? I'm giving you the answers. Numbers 22, verse 4. He called on Balaam to curse migrating Israel. Remember, Israel came through Moab to enter the land. Balak hired him. He was king of Moab. During the time of Judges, this is going to get very easy from here on in. King Eglon, one of the Gentile kings who put Israel under subjection for 18 years, Judges chapter 3, verse 12, he was the king of Moab. And during Saul's reign, there was war between Saul and Moab. During David's reign, there was war between David and the Moabites. If you'd like to keep your place here and turn to 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 2. You get a flavor of how severe and aggressive this warfare was. 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 2. And I'm going to begin reading for us in verse 1. 2 Samuel 8, 1. And after this, it came to pass that David smote the Philistines and subdued them. And David took Methgam and out of the hand of the Philistines, and he smote Moab and measured them with a line, casting them down to the ground. Even with two lines measured he to put to death, and with one full line to keep alive. And so the Moabites became David's servants and brought gifts. So he put them under tribute so that they paid tax to David's rule. And not only in the past, and not only the prophet Isaiah, but there are multiple prophets who announce judgment on Moab. Jeremiah chapter 48, and it's very interesting, if you would note that chapters 46 through 51 of Jeremiah are very similar to these chapters of Isaiah, announcing God's judgment upon Israel's Gentile neighbors and threats. So that's Jeremiah chapter 48. There are similar phrases that are used in that chapter. For example, verse 2, Isaiah chapter 15, verse 2, he has gone up to Bajith and Dibon, the high places, to weep. Moab shall howl over Nebo and over Bedeba. On all their heads shall be baldness and every beard cut off. Jeremiah 48, verse 37 says the exact same thing. And not only Jeremiah, Amos chapter 2 speaks of judgment on Moab. And Zephaniah chapter 2 and Ezekiel chapter 25 and Daniel. So even though there is a span of 130 years from the prophet Isaiah to the prophet Jeremiah, Moab is a persistent, hostile problem. Number two, there's a second reason why Moab is a problem. Moab's national deity is Chemosh. C-H-E-M-O-S-H. Now, I asked you a question about Balaam. Do you remember what else Balaam did that troubled Israel? Think of intermarriage and idolatry. The sin of Baal Peor. Balaam was the one who led Israel into those intermarriages. Do you know which nation they intermarried with? The Moabites. And that intermarriage led them into idolatry. And you remember the judgments that came upon the nation of Israel. The plague that the Lord sent to judge them because of the sin of Baal Peor. King Solomon, who loved the Lord, 1 Kings chapter 3. But he went on to love many other women, Gentile queens. And through the ease and wantonness of his lifestyle, he ended up making an altar to the god Chemosh. 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 17. There is a third reason. And this third reason is what we see actually in chapter 16 of Isaiah. The third reason that Moab is a problem, Isaiah chapter 16, verse 6, is Moab's pride. We have heard of the pride of Moab. He is very proud, even of his haughtiness and his pride and his wrath, but his lies shall not be so. In spite of being a small nation, the nation of Moab rejoiced at Israel's downfall, And here you read of their pride. Jeremiah chapter 48 verse 29 defines this pride as being defiance, magnifying himself against the Lord. So this shows us the seriousness with which we should consider the sin of pride. No matter what nationality, no matter what people, that sin is a problem and sin will be brought into judgment. We're not going to look at it right now, but it will come back. In the verses following the statement of Moab's sin, Moab was very proud of her vineyards. She was known for this. But in verse 7 and following, it is that very thing that is brought low, that is brought to nothing. And that is one of the ways that the Lord uses the very things that people take pride in to be the very thing that brings them low. So what is the coming judgment upon Moab? These are short chapters, but they are filled with difficult place names to pronounce. But I think it would benefit us if we were to take the time to read chapter 15. And while we're reading it, if you could note, make a mental note, or however you want to note it, make a note of the times that you will read the expression of wailing or weeping or crying. The burden of Moab, because in the night Ar of Moab is laid waste and brought to silence. Because in the night Ker of Moab is laid waste and brought to silence. He has gone up to Bajith and to Dibon, the high places, to weep. Moab shall howl over Nebo and over Madiba. On all their heads shall be baldness and every beard cut off. In their streets they shall gird themselves with sackcloth. On the tops of their houses and in their streets every one shall howl, weeping abundantly. And Heshbon shall cry, and Eleale, their voice shall be heard even unto Jahaz. Therefore the armed soldiers of Moab shall cry out, his life shall be grievous unto him. My heart shall cry out for Moab. His fugitives shall flee unto Zoar, an heifer of 3 years old, for by the mounting up of Luhith with weeping shall they go it up. For in the way of Horonaim they shall raise up a cry of destruction. For the waters of Nimrim shall be desolate, for the hay is withered away, the grass faileth, there is no green thing. Therefore the abundance they have gotten, and that which they have laid up, they shall carry away to the brook of the willows. For the cry is gone round about the borders of Moab, the howling thereof unto Eglaim, and the howling thereof unto Beralim. For the waters of Dimon shall be full of blood, for I will bring more upon Dimon, lions upon him that escapeth of Moab, and upon the remnant of the land. The last two verses, verses 8 and 9, are telling us that this is giving us a general view of the judgment that is coming upon Moab. And what makes this judgment upon Moab so memorable is not the graphic description of the army, or what the army did. Did you read what army it is that is going to destroy Moab? Did you read, in going through these verses, what that army will do? We're not told those things. We're not given a description of the army, nor are we told what they did. We're not told, is it one army or a confederacy of different armies? And that's because the appeal, what is so memorable about this prophecy, the appeal of it is not to the eye of our imagination, it is to the ear of our imagination. That's why the words wailing, crying, howling are repeated so many times. This is the wailing of the bereaved. So in verses 2 and 3, those who are bereaved, they clothe themselves with sackcloth. They shave their heads and they cut off their beards. These are evidences of shame and of mourning. They're going through the streets, it says in verse 3. And they're going through the streets mourning because of the successful nighttime raids that left these two prominent cities, Ar and Kir, silent. The reason they were silent, the defenders of these primary cities were left for dead. And so Moab grieves. We don't see the action, we hear the reaction of their wailing and their grief. That's very effective. When you don't actually see, but you get to hear the sorrow. You get to hear the grief. In verse 5, the person who is speaking here is the prophet himself. Even the prophet Isaiah is weeping and sorrowing because of what is happening to Moab. He sorrows for the refugees. So verse 5, it speaks of the fugitives, those who are having to flee because of this army that's come in and so successfully in this night raid silenced their prominent cities and their defenses. And it's interesting, in that same verse, you'll notice that they flee unto Zoar. Though we don't know the places of many of these other places, some of them are mentioned in Numbers chapter 21 and 22 when Israel came through this territory. But we do know that Zoar was the small town where Lot fled in Genesis chapter 19. And then not only are they grieved because of this military destruction, they are grieved because this fertile plain, verse 6, this place, these plains that had been lush with grass, where they had been able to harvest hay, these, verse 7, fertile places where they had been able to store up much of their harvests. They had been at ease and had had security of their fertile farms and their good grazing. And now, instead of that, there's crying and wailing because of their loss. There's a cross-reference between verses 6 and 7 and what Jeremiah is given to reveal in chapter 48, verse 11. He there paints the picture of how they were, they would decant their wine from one container into another. So over time, the husks of the grapes would sink to the bottom and they would pour it out into another one. They would leave the sediment behind and that would give them good grape juice. But it says in Jeremiah 48:11 that they had left it. They in their ease, they'd had it good for so long, they left their wine containers so that the juice was left on the sediment. But this was all turned over now. Their lush fields and their fertile farms, they were overrun and left desolate. And then in verse 9, the waters of Dimon, are now full of blood. The slaughter had been so drastic. And then the next phrase says that even though there had been such a terrible slaughter, The Lord will then send lions in, and they shall devour those who've escaped. The reader sees that judgment is coming on Moab. And the reader is to take God's side, that what God does is right and just. But the reader is also allowed to mourn the destruction, to see the cost that is coming upon this nation. Psalm 37, verse 1 tells us, "Fret not thyself because of evildoers, neither be thou envious against the workers of iniquity." We're not to get hot and bothered when we see the prosperity of the wicked, nor are we to be envious that we want to be like them. And then it goes on to say, "They shall soon be cut down like the grass and wither as the green herb." Instead of envy and instead of anger, we should have pity. We should have compassion on those who we see that judgment is coming for them, and give them the opportunity of rescue through the person of the Lord Jesus. So the first thing is the general, what we see in general. This is to happen upon the land of Moab. But that mourning of the whole land, now in chapter 16, focuses on some specifics. We're still dealing with the burden of Moab. There are two things that I'd like us to see that chapter 16 now focuses in on specific. So we have a huge light that has shone upon the whole land, and now it is narrowing in and focusing on those refugees. So those refugees are mentioned, how they are gathered at the fords of Arnon. "Send ye the lamb to the ruler of the land, from Selah to the wilderness unto the mount of the daughter of Zion. For it shall be that as a wandering bird cast out of the nest, so the daughters of Moab shall be at the fords of Arnon." These fleeing refugees are given this counsel in the prophecy of Isaiah, that they should send a lamb. So the idea here is that these refugees should send a tribute to the daughter of Zion. Now, would you keep your place here and turn to 2 Kings chapter 3. Do you remember how David vanquished Moab and he put them under tribute? That same situation arose when there were other kings in the nation of Israel. In 2 Kings chapter 3 and verse 4. This is when Joram the son of Ahab was king. And it says in verse 4, "And Mesha, king of Moab, was a sheepmaster, and rendered unto the king of Israel 100,000 lambs and 100,000 rams with the wool." So this situation had arisen before, when Moab was called upon to show their submission to Judah by sending tribute. This would be an acknowledgement that the real security in the Middle East is in God's purpose for Israel. It was then just as it is now. And Isaiah urges that the Moabites should acknowledge, they should show their trust by sending tribute to the one who was favored by the Lord. And then in verse 3, "Take counsel, execute judgment, make thy shadow as the night, in the midst of the noonday, hide the outcasts, bewray not him that wandereth. Let mine outcasts dwell with thee, Moab, Be thou a covert to them from the face of the spoiler, for the extortioner is at an end. The spoiler ceaseth, the oppressors are consumed out of the land. And in mercy shall the throne be established, and he shall sit upon it in truth in the tabernacle of David, judging and seeking judgment and hasting righteousness. So if their sending a tribute was an act of faith, now the prophet leaps forward to the end times. And now Moab are given counsel. Verse 4, let my outcast dwell with thee, Moab. In the end time tribulation, Moab are counseled to shelter the Jews who are fleeing in the tribulation from the persecution that arises because of the Antichrist. And in that time, when Antichrist is seeking to destroy the nation of Israel, when God resumes his program, his 70th week in his plan for Israel, so Moab are admonished, are advised again to show their faith by sheltering the Jews in that time. So that's one specific. To the fleeing refugees, we're given this specific word. But then in verse 6, we come to a second specific word, and this is the offense of Moab's sin. Do not think it light. Do not think it a light thing because we all are prone to pride. Do not think it a light thing because no one is harmed by my pride. It is an offense against God, and it is a serious matter. And so the rest of the chapter, again, the prophet, verse 7, picks up his sorrowing and howling for the nation of Moab. He sees the destruction that is coming, and he is sorry for the desolation. In more recent history, at the end of the 1800s, the German royal household brought forth an heir called Kaiser Wilhelm II. When Kaiser Wilhelm was a little child, a babe in arms, he was being carried by his nurse, his nanny, and somehow or other, in whatever she was running from, she tripped, and Kaiser Wilhelm fell, and his arm was damaged. His mother did everything that she could to try and restore his arm like the other, but it didn't develop normally. So Kaiser Wilhelm always wore a glove on that hand, and that arm was always shorter. It was something that he was especially sensitive about. He would hold it so that no one would see. He would ride so that nobody would be able to know. No one would be able to know. And because of that, that shaped his personality so that he was an explosive and proud and imperialist kind of person. If anybody crossed him, he would go from 0 to 120 in his rage. As a result of that, because of his involvement with the Austria-Hungarian military, that led to him being deposed. And it was then the warmongers amongst his military they were called the Wehrmacht. It was them that spawned the beginning of World War I. So it's not all Kaiser Wilhelm's fault, but one man's choice, one man's disposition, his personality, caused such destruction. They estimate that 10 million soldiers lost their lives in World War I. And then I'm sure you have seen pictures of the desolation, the flattening of everything green, that it all became a quagmire of bomb craters and devastation. They estimate that 15 to 22 million civilians were wounded. And I didn't find a figure for how many were displaced as a result of World War I. And that was only the wounded. 6 to 13 million civilians died in World War I. Doesn't that make you sad just to hear of those numbers? And so the prophet wails at the cost. The land that had been so fertile, the land that had plentiful fields and principal vineyards, is now brought to desolation. In verse 11, "Wherefore my bowels shall sound like an harp for Moab, and mine inward parts for Kir Haresh." This is devastating. But it is the effect of the judgment upon Moab that we are given to see its significance. We're not told the details of who started the war, the military action. We're told the sadness that it brings. This section in Isaiah encourages Israel to trust in the Lord. To trust in him alone. There is no undoing of his purpose. He will fulfill his purpose for Israel. They should trust in him alone. God has a purpose to make you more like his son. He will fulfill it. Faithful is he that calleth you, who also will do it. We should trust in him. But we should also be warned by this prophecy against Moab about the danger of our pride. In Matthew chapter 18, the disciples are asking the question, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus calls a little child and sets him in the midst, and he uses that little child to teach them a lesson. If you're there, it says in Matthew 18, verse 4, "Whosoever therefore shall humble himself as this little child, the same is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven." Martin Luther said that he learned some of his greatest lessons from watching children. The humility of children. James chapter 4 warns us that God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Those who are willing to humble themselves to obey the will of God. Let us be encouraged to trust in the Lord alone. He fulfills and will fulfill his purpose. And let us be encouraged to humble ourselves under the mighty hand of God. Let's pray.